Good morning, everybody.
Good morning.
We can do better than that. Good morning, everybody.
Good morning.
There we go. All right. My name is Aaron Dorfman. I'm the executive director of the National Committee for Responsive Philanthropy, which is a mouthful, but we usually just go by NCRP. Our organization's been around for 37 years, and we were founded to challenge grant makers to be more responsive to those with the least wealth and opportunity and power. Sometimes we're considered a watchdog organization or a friendly critic of foundations. Come on in, plenty of seats up here. For today's session, we're starting in this sort of formal part because the screen isn't that big and I had some slides that I want to share. We'll do about 30 minutes or so here, and then we're going to break into these small groups in the circles that you see in the other parts of the room. So we will hopefully have lots of time for your ideas and input into how to make your strategies more effective, how to get greater impact from your limited dollars. I'm also delighted to be joined in running this session by Ellen Friedman, executive director of the Compton Foundation. You want to wave your hand, Ellen? So, and you'll hear from her later. And also Mario Lugai and Tiffany Price from the Mitchell Capehorn Foundation. Both of those are family foundations based in the Bay Area. Can I just get a show of hands of people who are pretty satisfied? You think your foundation is pretty thoughtful, pretty strategic? You think you're getting the amount of impact that you'd like to be getting? Okay, good. Now, raise your hands, even if you raise your hands that you're pretty satisfied, raise your hands if you think you could be more impactful, more thoughtful, more strategic. All right, good, we're in the right session. You know, our sector, our field has been encouraged to become more and more strategic over the last decade. This has been, in my opinion, one of the dominant trends in philanthropy. And there's an entire literature on the subject, multiple books about how to do philanthropic strategy properly. We have conference sessions and convenings about strategy. But for all this strategy that people have been designing, we haven't made the kinds of strides that that people want in terms of impact and in terms of getting real results. So I'm going to spend about 10 minutes examining some of the pitfalls of strategic philanthropy as it's traditionally understood and practiced. I will share some of the key points from our new report that NCRP released a couple of hours ago online to the rest of the sector. It's called Real Results: Why Strategic Philanthropy is Social Justice Philanthropy. And you've all got copies on your chair there. So I'll hit some of the key points of that. And then you'll hear, well, how does this play out in practice? And these two Bay Area foundations are, in my mind, real leaders in practicing philanthropy in the kinds of ways that we recommend in this report. And they'll share some stories of what they do, why they do it, what kinds of results and impact it's been getting for the communities that their foundations care about. I also promise that at the end of the session today, you will leave this room with at least one new insight or new idea that may be helpful to you as you try to improve the work of your foundation. So words matter, so let's define our terms here. Strategic philanthropy, as it's traditionally been understood for the last decade or so, in their book on the subject, Paul Brest and Hal Harvey describe it as comprising clear goals, evidence-based strategy to achieve those goals, and feedback to help the foundation keep the strategy on course. So these are the hallmarks of it. These are the principles that I'm referring to when I say strategic philanthropy. But each of these tenets has some limitations as well. So one person's clear goals are another person's narrow foci. So we begin to see this world in terms of issue silos. A lot of foundations are getting narrower and narrower focus with the issues that they're trying to take on. They divide themselves into funders who care about education or health or the arts or the environment, but they're not working on the intersections of those issues. They're more and more narrowly focused on one particular set of objectives. That's one of the shortcomings of this increasing focus on clear goals. In terms of the evidence-based strategy, accountability and evaluation and metrics certainly should be designed to support your evidence-based strategy, but too often, at least as we see it, the burden of that accountability and of getting those metrics for an evidence-based strategy, it's just simply passed on to the grantees in terms of overly burdensome paperwork and things that they're asked to collect. And regardless of whether those indicators or metrics are really helping the grantees or the funder make any better progress toward. So it's not to say they shouldn't be done, but often in practice, it's not nearly as helpful as it was thought to be when people were designing the evidence-based strategies. I also see some limitations that sometimes strategic philanthropy can have an overly technocratic view of the world. And what I mean by that, just sort of linear thinking where A leads to B leads to C. And sometimes change happens in the world that way, but often it's a whole lot messier than that. And you can't really predict when and how the breakthroughs are going to occur on major issues of importance in your communities. And you've got to be positioned for a lot of other possible outcomes. And so the linear or technocratic approach doesn't always yield results. An example of that would be on climate change. A lot of the climate change funders have thought that by producing the science, the irrefutable science that says that climate change is real, put the facts in the hands of the legislators, and surely they'll pass something, they'll do something. That hasn't exactly played out for us. And I think we did a whole report on why that strategy fell short. So this report that we're releasing today is really the culmination of a series of four that we did in our High Impact Strategies for Philanthropy series. Some of you may have seen some of these reports. We did one for health funders, education funders, arts funders, and environmental funders. And we said, if you're a funder who primarily cares about this particular issue, what would it mean to be operating beyond your narrow silo, to not be so technocratic in your approach, but to in fact fund a bottom-up grassroots strategy that builds power in communities for long-lasting real change? We partnered with the affinity groups on each of those reports, both to get the content right and also for dissemination and discussion. So if you've been a part of any of those affinity groups, you know that our reports have been talked about at the conferences the last couple of years there. But all this siloing is something that I'm hoping that our field can begin to move beyond. I think there was a place for focus, but there's also a place for cross-issue work and moving beyond silos. And so we're really making a contention in this new report that we released today, why, in fact, we need to merge the best principles from strategic philanthropy and the best principles from social justice philanthropy as it's traditionally been practiced, and how by doing that we're going to see more powerful, lasting results for families and communities and causes that all the foundations care about. I've covered all that. Yes. So We're beginning to think about strategic philanthropy's learning curve. And so in this figure, which you will see appearing multiple times throughout the report and through the presentation, on the vertical axis, you've got a measurement of where your foundation might be on an increasing focus on social justice. How much are you emphasizing systems change work? How much are you prioritizing or empowering underserved or marginalized communities? And how robustly are you funding advocacy, community organizing, or civic engagement by those who are most affected by the problems you're trying to work on? And on the horizontal axis, where might you fall on that curve in terms of an increasing focus on strategy as you move further out to the right? How much do you have an emphasis on clear goals, measurable impact, and feedback to help adjust your strategy as it goes on? So we kind of think that philanthropy's present has moved, its origins were more charity, not particularly focused on social justice or on strategy. Our present has made far more progress along the strategy axis than it has along the social justice axis. And our hope is that it will continue to make progress in an accelerating fashion on the vertical axis, on the social justice axis of this curve. So let's see what that would look like in terms of the principles of strategic philanthropy. So with the clear goals, we can temper that strategic excess through targeting. So a clear understanding of your goals, though your goals may be universal in nature, you may want to, for example, increase college completion to a certain percentage in your community, as the Lumina Foundation has identified in their new strategic plan. So that's a universal goal, but they understand that they can't get there without a targeted strategy for different groups who, in fact, face different challenges when faced with actually completing college. So Latinos have different challenges than non-Hispanic white people do, and African Americans have different challenges, and women have different challenges. And so the Lumina Foundation's strategic plan, I think, actually shows this targeted universalism in action quite well. They've got a universal goal, but targeted strategies for different population groups designed to help them get there. And their grant making is reflecting those. Does that make sense, the targeted universalism? Sometimes that one is a little fuzzy for people. I'm getting head nods. All right, feel free to interrupt me with questions if it's not. Here might be an example on the curve to illustrate this. Going back to our curve. So arts funders often fund some cherished cultural institutions, but despite many efforts of nonprofits to diversify the arts, we often still wrestle with how to ensure this powerful form of overcoming difference is equitably available to all. So we're not saying stop funding the arts, but perhaps consider strategies that can intentionally engage communities of color and other communities that have been left out of the cultural the standard bearer institutions in each of our communities. So the silo of evidence-based strategy and its limitations sometimes shuts us off from policy engagement. Commitment to meaningful measurement acknowledges the imperative of influencing public policy and a level of comfort with uncertainty, right? We never quite know when we're going to be able to move a policy change through. So in seeking these ever more precise ways to measure impact, we miss the tangible and real impact that advocacy, community organizing, civic engagement strategies can have for all of our citizens and across multiple issues. Some of you may have seen another series of reports that we did trying to measure this impact of foundation investments in advocacy. We did a three-year study across seven sites, spent more than $1 million doing the research, and we found a return on investment of 115 to 1, that for every dollar that foundations and other donors invested in grassroots advocacy and civic engagement work, communities got $115 back in benefits. That series of reports is also available on our website, as all our research is. Yes, it's good to measure things, but sometimes the measurement takes a very long time. Here's an example around health, again, going back to our learning curve. A grant maker might fund a new hospital wing, or might a more social justice approach, and probably further along the strategy axis as well, would be to fund a coalition working on healthcare reform. And in fact, we documented lots of incredibly large impacts from healthcare reform groups and the benefits that that brings to families and communities from those local fights. Finally, how do we overcome the technocratic linearity that sometimes can be a pitfall of traditional strategic philanthropy? Setting and keeping a justice-driven strategy on course demands the input of those who stand to gain or lose the most from the grant making. The grantees and the communities they serve, bringing them to the table with your foundation as you're setting your strategy really helps you avoid, it keeps you real, keeps your strategies really real and grounded in the experience of the folks that you're trying to benefit. Yes?
So we live in a world of next gen from this conference. The one thing that the next generation has taught us is that building strategies out of conversations doesn't usually work, as well as building strategies out of testing. And the whole essence of web marketing is built around this strategy, and there are increasingly companies and experts who are adopting this thinking. Gary Hamel's last book was on this topic, and Intuit, which is just a few months north of here, has built their entire company around the concept that every strategy is tested, it's not discussed. So how does that get incorporated into this? Because this, to me, looks like a strategy setting through conversation-based approach. How do we build in what we've learned from the web generation about how to build strategy through testing?
Excellent question. Could everybody hear it? Yes, good. I think it's when it's working at its best, it's an iterative process of partnership between the foundation and its grantees and the community that it's trying to benefit. And so, in fact, you've got some discussion. Hey, let's try this strategy, test it out, see how it works, and then refine it and talk some more and really go back to each other. And I think I'll ask Ellen and Mario and Tiffany to talk if they've done that with any of their grantees as their foundations have evolved. But absolutely, it's not about setting a strategy and then not wavering from it for years to come, because that feedback on a regular basis is really important. And Ellen's nodding, so I know she'll have some good things to say about how they've done that. Does that make sense? I would rather do it out of discussion with the grantees first, and then, discussion first with the people affected, pick some options, try some things, see how it works, and evolve it, rather than discussion with experts only, which is, I think, the traditional technocratic approach, expert-driven strategy choices, not informed by those most effective. I think that's where traditional strategic philanthropy has fallen short.
Go ahead.
Yeah. So education. Education funders, of course, most of them do acknowledge the very real need for systemic change when they seek to identify and train reform-minded administrators, for example, as the Broad Foundation does on its education work. They're certainly following a strategy designed to achieve systemic change, but where they've sometimes missed the mark is where will the political will for their reforms come from? How will those leaders that they're training and putting into place in the schools be held accountable to teachers, to parents, and to the students that they serve? And so another group of funders are actually putting more of a bet on parent organizing and engagement so that there's a political will in local communities to hold those districts accountable to better results. And some of those funders, we've certainly seen some good results from there. So Paul Brest and Hal Harvey in their strategic philanthropy book, they argue that a sound strategy makes success possible, and its absence virtually ensures failure. So I agree with that. But I also, we're trying to raise with this report the idea that justice and thinking about justice is in fact an essential element of a sound strategy. And so its absence from some of our philanthropic discussions has diminished our impact. We've been too divorced from including that element of justice and why it matters to our strategies. And so our hope is that in the coming years, strategy and justice can be coming closer and closer together so that what is strategic is just and what is just is strategic, and so that strategic philanthropy at its best is actually social justice philanthropy. That's the approach that we're putting forward as philanthropy's future direction here. And I'm going to now hope that my other panelists can, through talking about their work, really make this real. And then, after we've heard from them, we'll break into the smaller groups for discussions, and we can talk about what it means for each of us and what we might do or try at our own foundations. So with that, let me turn it over to Tiffany Price and Mario Lugai from the Mitchell Kapor Foundation.
I'm just going to use the podium mic, if that's okay. Great, thanks. So happy to be here. Thank you. Thank you to Aaron. The Mitchell Kapor Foundation's kind of long-term goals, in order to reach them, we know that we actually need social justice philanthropy to be normal and familiar rather than unique or extraordinary. And so we consider the work that Aaron does not only helpful to the work we do, but also necessary for us to actually get to where we're hoping to get. So we're always happy to join Aaron. I think what I'm going to do is just talk maybe less scientifically about some of the work we do, but more personally about how we approach this work. In college, a decade or so ago, I was really moved by this book. It was by Paula Giddings, who talked about the experience of Black women in the social justice movement, and she wrote that only when Black women can dictate when and where they enter, in the quiet, undisputed dignity of womanhood, without violence, without suing or special patronage, then and there, the whole race will enter with her. So this notion, to me, it's the same notion as targeted universalism, right? It's not until the most marginalized folks can actually not just join in the movement or join into society on an equal footing, but when they actually have the agency and are allowed to dictate how and when and where they enter, can we move forward as a society? For me, targeted universalism was also kind of best said by the late Senator Paul Wellstone. in his very simple phrasing, he said, we all do better when we all do better. And so for the KPOR Foundation, the question is, who's not doing better, right? Who's struggling? Who's marginalized? And looking to support those groups in doing better so that we all do better, right? And that's what first drew me to the Mitchell KPOR Foundation. And what I'm going to share is just a small kind of glimpse into some of the work we do, not all of the work. I was hired in 2010 to work on the Voice program area. That's the Voting Integrity and Civic Engagement program area. And when that was started around 2006, it was focused on the question of when and where do marginalized communities, do people of color communities enter into the electoral arena, right? And based on its findings, analysis, conversations, we found there was multiple barriers to participation by people of color communities in elections. And that ranged from just voter engagement groups led by people of color that sought to mobilize communities of color, young folks. It also included voter protection work and ensuring that when people did vote, that their vote counted. And it also involved money in politics and looking at the ways in which that affected elections. So the foundation supported that variety and range of work for its first 3 years. And then when I joined in 2010 to actually lead that work, conditions had changed, and they had changed fundamentally thanks to, just to name folks in the room, Laura Levati, who was then at FACT, that's right, French American Charitable Trust, and then a couple of folks who aren't in the room. It was Laura, it was Molly from the Unitarian Universalist Veatch program at Shelter Rock. I'll get in trouble if I don't mention the whole thing. Guillermo Quinteros at Solidago Foundation, but they had pushed philanthropy to begin to look at a new way of supporting low-income communities of color to engage electoral politics. It was a strategy called integrated voter engagement, where groups doing ongoing organizing work integrated voter engagement work into their ongoing work in ways that left infrastructure past elections. So I joined then, and with the new conditions, we changed our focus, right? It was a slight shift, but it was a shift to meet those changing conditions. We went from funding a wide variety of groups, working on a wide variety of issues around elections and low-income communities of color, to narrow focus, funding Bay Area-based community organizing groups who were engaging the elections together so that they could work at scale. And because we are funding a strategy, which is electoral and voter engagement by low-income communities of color who are doing organizing work, it was necessarily multi-issue, right? It wasn't about issues per se, but about the strength of these communities to engage issues. The shift to that allowed for several things that were really important in terms of the question that we asked of ourselves regarding when and where and how do foundations, how do funders and program officers enter into existing movements for change, right? By focusing on a local ecosystem, we were able to become better informed funders, because the area of focus was narrow enough that we could build our expertise on it in a way that was manageable. We were also able to be much more responsive because we knew the conditions, how they were changing, and the opportunities that were arising, and the threats as well to folks' work, and support groups in responding rapidly to that. And by funding a local ecosystem, it gave us the best chance possible to actually see the work that often gets invisibilized, that isn't able to rise up to the radar. But because our focus was on that ecosystem, not only were we able to see it as the work kind of popped up, but we were able to hear it from our grantees. And the last piece that we felt really was important in deciding on an ecosystem to fund was by doing so, it made visible something that's unique to, I think, social justice organizations, which is most of them aren't large enough or to the scale that they alone can affect change or the change that they hope for, right? That they necessarily work in partnership with each other. And by funding an ecosystem and making that visible and stating that very clearly, I think we lift up that interdependence and the codependence by groups alongside each other, and hopefully help push back against some of the mentality of scarcity between the groups or the zero-sum mentality. So that's what we've done. A little bit about our work. I think just reflecting on some of the stuff that Aaron said, for us, this approach of centralizing low-income communities of color in a way that we believe it's critical that they define how, when, and where they enter into this work, that our focus is on the goals, right? That for all the testing, working with a lot of younger folks who are doing testing and using that approach, what they'll always say is that the limits to a strategy of more scientific work, of more strategic philanthropy of testing, is that if you don't set up the right questions and if you don't develop the right goals that are informed by the widest set of actors possible, then the testing doesn't matter. And so that's what we do. In addition to the actually who you grant, we also believe very strongly in how we do grant making, how we enter into the social justice world. And so I'm going to turn it over to Tiffany, who works even more closely with our grant recipients around that.
Good morning, everyone. I am the Director of Assistance and Advising, and I joined the Mitchell K. Poor Foundation in 2008. One of the reasons I was really, really attracted to working at the Mitchell K. Poor Foundation was its commitment to the notion that philanthropy does not have all the answers. So a lot of foundations fund within specific program areas. They might fund strategies, they might fund issues, but through this, you know, area of assistance and advising, and the title was even more attractive when I first started. It was grantee advocate, and I loved the name of that that title. But it was the notion that sometimes grant recipients need support and services above and beyond the grant. Maybe it's not, you know, about the direct service that they're involved in. Sometimes it's the not-so-sexy things that an organization needs support in to better enable them to fulfill their mission. So that's what I was focused on, meeting organizations where they are. And so my quest when I started in 2008 was to build a different kind of relationship with the organizations that we fund. As a non-program officer, I really wanted to get into the nitty-gritty of the underlying issues that were sometimes getting in the way of organizations being able to do their work. One simple example is from an organization that we've supported, Mujeres Unidas y Activas. It's a small, very grassrootsy organization. If you go to any of their events or meetings, everything is in Spanish and translated into English, as opposed to primarily English being translated into Spanish. It kind of goes both ways, but it's a super scrappy organization in San Francisco. And being small and grassrootsy, one of their issues was they wanted to have a staff retreat. And they were able to come to us and say, we want to have a staff retreat. We don't have a location for this. We had a lovely space in San Francisco with lots of big conference room spaces, a kitchen, you know, things that we take for granted within philanthropy that can be a great service to a small, scrappy nonprofit like this one. So they were able to use our facility for the day and do some really engaging work together to move forward their mission in ways that, you know, you can't necessarily quantify, you can't write a whole lot about it in a report in terms of the impact the foundation was able to make for a nonprofit. But for that particular organization, it was a lot. Other ways that we have tried to do this was around making our internal staff expertise available to the organizations that we fund. For example, we had an in-house creative team that was focused on things like marketing, video development, website enhancements, things like that, that again, we take for granted within philanthropy that organizations have the money to pay for things like that. But for, say, an organization that wants to promote a particular campaign, they might need a logo. They might need some paraphernalia to put out into the world to make a bigger case for them in areas where it's necessary. So we were able to take our staff, pay for their time, to spend quality time with nonprofits that they may or may not have had an opportunity to build that type of relationship with, and make some impact. So not just in creating products, but also skill building along the way. So not just technical assistance, but also the capacity building, the internal capacity building piece, so that when the foundation may or may not have a relationship with that organization any longer, they are still able to use the skills in Photoshop or whatever other technical expertise they were able to glean from that engagement with these folks. So I just want to highlight the importance of relationship building, trust building outside of the grant relationship, being flexible. Another area is around grants management and streamlining a lot of our grant making processes based on feedback that we have gotten over the course of our relationships with some of the organizations that we funded, to make sure that, you know, if we're giving them a $20,000 grant, that we're not asking them to jump through a lot of hoops in order to get that. So those are just a couple of the points that I want to highlight from my area of work with the foundation.
And I should have said when I introduced them, the Mitchell K. Poor Foundation is a Bay Area-based foundation. Mitch and Frida K. Poor are living donors. They're still around. Mitch founded Lotus Notes, so that gives a unique character to their foundation. And how big are you guys in terms of annual giving or assets?
We have about $40 million, and assets give about $2 to $4 million
in assets and $2 to $4 million a year in giving. Mitch is still making new money with his investments as well, still doing venture capital stuff. So now we'll hear from Ellen Friedman and what they do at the Compton Foundation.
Thank you. So we're a little bit of a different animal. We are a 60-year-old national family foundation that has been, from its inception, focused on ending war and supporting environmental protection and supporting women's reproductive rights and justice. The foundation is interesting in that it is half family and half non-family on our board, and so built into the DNA of the organization is a rotating group of activists, grantees, advisors who come from the communities that we serve. The foundation has now about $60 million in assets. We give away about $3.5 million a year, and we're national in our focus. The foundation has always identified itself as a progressive foundation. It's had deep values of supporting justice and equity, peace, and a sustainable future for the planet. The family, over time, has spread, and so nobody lives in California anymore, even though we are a California-based foundation. So we've had to really struggle with the issue of place and how do we think about our work as the generations have shifted in the foundation. So 2 years ago, I was hired as a new executive director. I followed an executive director who had been there for over 20 years. At the same time, a new board chair stepped into leadership at the foundation. The first woman to chair the board in 60 years of the foundation's history. And the two of us felt like it was really obviously an incredible moment to embark on an assessment of what we were doing, how we were doing it, what our purpose was, what were we being called to do. And the foundation had these three program areas: peace, environment, women's reproductive rights, and justice. Three different consultants, they never met. They never talked. They had three different committees. There was never a discussion at the a board level about what the program, I mean, there were some discussions, but never strategic discussions that were anything other than, well, this is the environment program, this is the peace program, this is the women's reproductive justice program. The foundation had done fabulous, and I think continues to do fabulous grant making in the area of policy, research, organizing, advocacy, but within these silos. And as we began to step back and look at our program, what we recognized was that exactly what Aaron highlighted, which is that the deep level of change that we wanted in each of the silos wasn't happening. And when we stepped back and looked, we recognized that the world was working, and kind of the most cutting-edge organizations were working in a much more interconnected way. And so what we did out of our planning process was to recommit ourselves to the history of the foundation in these three areas, but to say that there are cross-cutting strategies that actually impact all of them. And we focused on transformative, we're now focusing on transformative leadership, looking at the new ways that people work together across silos to advance key social justice issues, and what we're calling courageous storytelling, which is a focus on culture change, saying that we need to help develop a new narrative about the future, and in order to do that, we need to tell a new story about what our future looks like, and that story has to be one that looks at the interconnected nature of how everything works together. So what we did is the board came up with a new mission statement, these strategies. And then we said, well, we need to talk to the folks who are on the ground doing this work. We need to bring in our existing grant partners and some potential new grant partners. And we need to test, reality test, whether or not this actually makes any sense to them. Are we, like, just, you know, in our board process coming up with something that won't have meaning to people on the ground? So we convened three listening conversations with eight people each. In each conversation, we brought people from each of the silos into a discussion with one another. We put our new mission and vision statement up on the wall. And for 2 hours over lunch, we listened. And we got great feedback. We adapted our strategies and our approach based on that feedback. And I really want to underscore something that Tiffany said. What happened in those conversations was the beginning of a relationship that was different. We entered that relationship with a sense of curiosity and engagement, and so we began to develop trust and a relationship that was new for the foundation's relationship with its grant partners. We changed some of our grants processes because of that. We now make 60% of our grants as general operating support. We went from only grant making 2 times a year to grant making 6 times a year. I'm not quite sure how we're surviving that, but we did that because what we also heard in those sessions was that the work was changing, the speed at which people were having to adapt and respond was shifting dramatically. And if we wanted to be relevant and meet the needs of the people that we were working with and partnering with, we had to be able to adapt our grant making accordingly. So I'm working on a grant right now that came up last week that will go to the board on Friday and will hopefully get approved and money out the door by next Friday, a week from Friday, which is responding to the needs of some folks working on reproductive justice issues in Missouri. And that happened because we opened up and have created a new kind of dialogue with folks and an opportunity for quick turnaround. We also created a fund for convening, which we think it is, if we want to do really honest cross-silo work, we have to create the spaces for people to be able to talk to each other. So I quickly want to talk about three different groups that we have funded in the last year as examples of this. I'm going to take some water. One of the groups is a new group called Ultraviolet. Ultraviolet is an online effort created by two young women to end sexism. Now, you might think that that is, you know, a silo in and of itself, but when you see the kind of campaigns that Ultraviolet is embarking on, they cover everything from issues related to violence against women, women on corporate boards, healthcare reform, women in the military, and other kinds of issues, linking together women and men in a way that they can act online and in partnership with grassroots groups to engage in actions. Just last week, Ultraviolet was able to garner 70,000 signatures on an online petition. They partnered with Choice USA, who 2 days ago delivered to the state attorney general in Ohio a petition saying that they must investigate and not stop looking at the rape of a young woman in Ohio that was potentially going to be left behind. So it's a new form of organizing. It's also a new way of looking at cross-silo, what the issues are, of partnering with groups on the ground to deliver a kind of strategic action, and in the same time, begin to get a message out. In their first year of operations, they now have an online membership of over 500,000, which is really exciting. The second group I want to highlight is different in nature because it's both local and national, Forward Together, formerly known as Asian Communities for Reproductive Justice. They changed their name because what they realized is that the variety of issues that they were working on in order to promote access to reproductive justice covered things like how we define families, how we support environmental issues in local communities, how we support immigration issues in local communities, LGBT issues, et cetera. And so they're working in a variety of ways to say it's not reproductive justice covers and touches all of these issues. They're not separate. Families have issues that are not just in a silo. One of the things that we really particularly appreciate about Forward Together is they're doing very traditional organizing in communities like Oakland and around the country, but they're also using culture strategies. Check their website for their Mama's Day cards, and this year they're going to have Papa's Day cards that are trying to create images and beautiful images, in fact, working with local artists of what families look like today. They are incredibly diverse, and Forward Together really has integrated a culture approach as well as an intersectionality approach that I think is really important. And then the last project I want to highlight is something called the Social Transformation Project, which has been building relationships between national membership-based organizations for people to be able to get to know each other. That group has been meeting for over 2 years, and you know, for a long time people were like, well, what's going to come out of this? We're creating relationships. Well, in December, some of you may have heard about a new initiative nationally called the Democracy Initiative. It's something that is headed by the NAACP, the Sierra Club, Greenpeace, SEIU, Communication Workers of America, as well as a number of other organizations who have never worked together before. But they all came together and said, we all care about democracy. We care about campaign finance reform. We care about voting rights. And this is something that affects all of our issues. And because they have spent the time it takes to build trust and relationship, the work that is now going to emerge from that, I think, will be very, very powerful and something that will have great impact. So I really love the NCRP report. I think it's really important and something for us to all take to heart. But I want to add one piece that I think is essential for us all to think about when we think about not working in silos, and that is thinking about the 95% of our assets and how they're invested. One of the things that we have done over the last 2 years is the Compton Board has committed to becoming 100% invested in mission-related investments. We are voting our proxies on issues of campaign contributions and transparency about issues related to women on boards, disclosure of environmental and sustainability practices. It is really essential that we think about how we deploy all of our assets, because until we really do that and think about everything that we own and all of the things that we have, I think we're not going to be able to move the needle in the way that most of us really want to see the change happen. And I think I'll end with saying that I think this work requires a deep level of trust and comfort with ambiguity, that sometimes you're investing in things that you really don't know what the outcome is going to be. I think the Social Transformation Project for me is the best example of that, that just building relationships actually is a pretty important thing. And trusting that the people in the room who are committed to social justice and transformation will come out of that process with something that we don't know what it looks like right now. I don't think 2 years ago people would have thought that the Democracy Initiative would take the form that it takes, but those were really committed, passionate, deeply skilled organizers. And so by giving them the opportunity to create relationships and to dream and think outside of their silos, something new has emerged. And so I think that work is really critical for us to trust that that change will happen, and it will look very different than it looks now. Thanks.
Great. All right, so now I'm going to ask that we break into our three discussion groups so we can really talk about this stuff and what it means. So Tiffany and Mario will be leading this circle up here. Ellen will be leading the circle back by the water, and I will be leading the circle back by the soundboard. And some suggested things that we might discuss. Of course, introduce yourselves to everybody in the group. But also, you may want to talk about where is your, where is your foundation now in terms of this the strategy continuum and the social justice axis? Where are you now? Where do you want your foundation to be on that curve in the next, 5 years or so? What might be some challenges or obstacles that you would face in moving from where you are now to where you want to be? And what might be some next steps that you could take to keep your foundation moving in the direction that you want it to go? So, and we'll have 30 minutes for small groups. If you can get a volunteer who will just report back, one or two interesting nuggets or ideas that come up in your discussion. We're not looking for a full recap of everything you discussed, but one or two really salient ideas. We'll come back together for the final 5 minutes of the session. All right, so we just want to share some wisdom from the two groups, just anything interesting or noteworthy that you guys came up with. Who's going to share a thought or two with us? Did you pick someone?
We had a wide-ranging conversation. We spent a fair amount of time actually talking about the question of culture change and how to do that, how to think about that. We also talked about the need to focus on underlying causes and values that might unify work across silos. We had a number of people in our group who are doing really interesting work in place-based kinds of strategies, and so people shared some of their experience in the work that they've been doing.
Great. Did you miss anything that needs to get said? Okay. Who's going to report for our group? Democratic. All right, there we go.
So we really focused on the collaboration efforts of smaller foundations and how you build community around them and how do you find support, especially for many of the organizations here have no staff or limited staff. So how do you build those networks that kind of helps move your mission forward but also leverage along the way?
Awesome. Did he leave anything out that needs to get said? All right, well, please join me in thanking Ellen and Tiffany and Mario for their great insights here. And thank you all for coming, and don't forget to do your evaluations, which Chris has.